From Toronto, it's time for your weekly dose of conservation information here on Canada's All Environmental News Hour. On behalf of the CIUT 89.5 in Toronto and our fantastic community radio partners across the country, I'm Darren Kaster and welcome to the Green Majority. This week, we have a couple of fun guests. We have Jennifer Bikewell, who's the director and film producer behind Manufactured Landscapes, among many other well-known films and well-accredited films. She is going to be doing a talk as well as receiving the Eco Hero Award from this year's Planet in Focus Film Festival, which is happening in Toronto from October 10th to 14th. So we hear from her in the first half talking a little bit about some of her films, some of the inspiration for her films, and her awkward, her admittedly awkward recipient. She feels like she's in pretty strong company. I don't know. I think she's pretty right up there with the other recipients. But we hear from her in the first half as far as the Planet in Focus Film Festival and being an eco hero and whatnot. Second half, we'll be speaking to Zina Maria, which gets points just for having an awesome name. Sierra Youth Coalition has a Sustainable Campus Conference 2012. We'll be speaking to Zina in the second half regarding that. And then always, as always, or as usual, I should say, back from the beyond of the summer, we have Kevin Farmer, who's going to be wrapping up the show with us. So without any further ado, we're going to get right started now. We'll hear first from Jennifer Bikewell. So we're speaking today to Jennifer Bikewell. She is the inspiring filmmaker behind such things you may have heard of as Manufactured Landscapes, Act of God, Payback, True Meaning of Pictures, and several other films. Thank you so much for joining the Green Majority today, Jennifer.
Oh, you're welcome. Very happy to be here.
You've been a filmmaker for quite some time. You've had many award-winning films. Not through all of them, but through many of them, there's been a common theme of viewing the environment in a very general sense through the eyes of artists. So I was wondering if you want to just start off by just talking a little bit about where do you get the sorts of ideas and what sort of inspirations you use when you go about choosing to pursue a project.
Well, I mean, when I would say that probably Manufactured Landscapes was the first film where we were focusing on a kind of ecological reality, the ecological reality of the Industrial Revolution in China. And I've always been sort of an environmentalist and interested and following environmental discourse. And there was a real low point where I think the exhorting kind of doom scenarios in the literature were failing to move people. And when I first encountered Bertinsky's work, I was just struck very much by the fact that you're engaging with these photographs created a dialogue that you had with yourself about your own impact, environmentally and ecologically, without preaching at you. The photographs they weren't didactic. They were experiential, and somehow because of that, they were more powerful. And I started to think about that as a new environmental discourse. And when we were approached by Bertinsky to make the film, it was kind of the intention was to really make the film an extension of what the photographs did in that way by being experiential and non-didactic. And also because our films up until that point have been pretty, they're elliptical shapes, they're not linear shapes. They don't sort of force the viewer to a particular conclusion, and there was a real similarity there, I think, in the way that Nick and I have always worked with Ed's work, that worked well together, and that's kind of how it started. And I do think that art in general is a very rich arena for inquiry into the human and ecological condition, because it's unparaphrasable in a fundamental way, and I guess in that way it is experientially based. Like, it is something that you have to experience to know, and if it could be paraphrased, if you could sort of explain it and understand it without encountering it or having an experience of it, then it wouldn't be art. So that's another reason why we've always been drawn to that sort of artistic writers, photographers, etc. In our work.
They're going to be showing manufactured landscapes during the Planet in Focus Film Festival. That's why we've chosen this particular time to speak to you. If you happen to be in Toronto, that's going to be running from October 10th to October 14th. They'll be showing manufactured landscapes on the 12th, that's the Friday, and that following that, there's going to be a presentation of the Eco Hero Award, of which you are the Canadian recipient this year. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So I've had you, when I was at University of Toronto, I had you come into one of my classes. That was actually the first time that I'd seen manufactured landscapes. We didn't watch the whole film, but the instructor left some time for some Q&A, and I imagine you've probably done many of those. When you're sort of in the room, you know, you talked about letting the visual speak for itself. I'm interested to know what sorts of reactions you've experience when people see your film for the first time or have an opportunity to sort of ask you questions afterwards. What are the sort of reactions you get to Bertinsky's photographs?
Well, I mean, when we first started showing the film, remember all of, you know, when you're in an editing room doing your work, and our films generally take about a year to edit, so it's a fairly isolated process. And so the experience of showing it, showing the film to an audience is always sort of thrilling and terrifying at the same time. And that film premiered at the Toronto Film Festival, and we'd never shown it to a large group. And I remember feeling how there was a heaviness to it at the end, like people were kind of silent before they responded by clapping and stuff. And I thought, I mean, it's the first time that I got a question that was, what do we do now? What do we do? And I hadn't really, you know, when we started off this film, it was not meant to be an activist film in any way. It was a meditative film about the work of a photographer. But as we entered into that world, and I was transformed by our experience in China, and I have to say that, you know, I feel completely out of my depth in the company that I keep, being a Canadian eco-hero. But I was really transformed by China. And when people started asking that question, I had to figure out a way to answer it. And I would say that in all the screenings of that film that we've had, and we've gone all over the world with that film, there has been a kind of a common thread in the questions and the comments, which are this reflection back on yourself and your own place in this process of consumption and waste that we are responsible for, but never normally see the places where these things go when we throw them away, and the factories where the things we use every day and then discard are made. And I think when you spend time in those environments, it is consciousness changing, as it was for me. And so in the film, we really tried to extend the consciousness changing nature of the photographs into the medium of film. So, you know, for example, there's a very long opening tracking shot in that film, which is a dolly shot on a factory floor that is 3/4 of a kilometer long. And the scale of that factory, this is just one room in the factory, was unbelievable. And we kept trying to figure out, how are we going to convey this scale in a time-based medium such as film? I mean, you can't just show the photographs of a photographer in a film and your job is done. Like, that's a failure of the medium. Like, there has to be some kind of intelligent translation. And Peter Mettler and I spent a lot of time talking about how to intelligently translate Bertinsky's photographs into the medium of film. And I would say that opening is probably a perfect example of where we came to from these long conversations and this grappling, because unless you convey scale and time, you don't understand it in a film. So that tracking shot is about 10 minutes long, and I think that people get, you know, at first they're sort of incredulous at how big this place is, and they get bored, and then they get kind of angry, looking like, why am I looking at this for so long? And somehow out of that combination of incredulity, boredom, and anger comes a true recognition of scale. So the way that the film worked with the photographs was to really try to make them intelligently work in the medium of film. And I think that the responses of audiences have been very much an extended response to what they would see if they went to an exhibition of Brzezinski's photographs. A little bit different because it's experiential in a different way, but similar in that the experiential and non-didactic elements were the same.
Mm-hmm. It's potentially a bit outside your expertise, but I'd be interested to know anyways. I mean, we talk a lot about on this program about the idea of Canadian environmentalism being, you know, a mile wide and an inch deep, in that everyone sort of cares about the environment, but they're easily distracted by other things. So where I'm going with that is you're saying, you know, you found it surprising and you sort of weren't prepared for the, you know, people finishing watching the film and then sort of a shocked silence and then people asking you, okay, so what do we do now? It seems that, you know, to what degree would you say that people's inactivity to the degree that they are inactive or uninterested in environmental issues and the sorts of, you know, repercussions of our modern society are simply that they're simply ignorant of, you know, it's that, you know, CDs show up at the CD shop and, you know, food shows up at the grocery store, and that people are just kind of numb to everything else that has to happen for that to get there, and that simply by showing them that, they're so enlivened by that information that they immediately want to act.
Well, I do think, I mean, I think when you talk about a mile wide and an inch deep, I don't think that's just restricted to Canada. I think you could characterize quite a lot of the Western industrial world as in that way. So I do think that when I was talking about environmental discourses failing, the idea of being presented with a place you are responsible for but would never normally see, which is what Brzezinski does in those photographs and what we try to do in the film, is quite consciousness changing. And I do think there is a thread that most people don't think about at all. I mean, people are too busy to think about that. And once you're presented with it, and your direct relationship with it, I think that's consciousness changing. And I think consciousness changing is what leads to a change in behavior. I really do. I don't think you can just take it on as an intellectual exercise. I think you have to be moved, and you have to be moved by really being with the people who make the things that you use mm-hmm. every day, like the women who are making the spray mechanisms for irons in that factory. I mean, that factory made 20 million irons a year. The scale is mind-boggling, and yet somehow they all get sold and used and then discarded at some point, right? Not that I was a dollar store frequenter, but mm-hmm. I do have children, and you know, the dollar store was always a sort of a loot bag birthday party destination, not just for when my children came home. But I've been in those stores a few times, and after seeing the painstaking effort that goes into making the things that we consider to be disposable, it's an incredibly humbling moment, and it makes you realize that there's just, I mean, I've just never gone into one of those stores in 15 years, but it makes you realize how unnecessary so much of it is in the chain of consumption waste that we are all very much engaged in. So I do think awareness is the first stage, and awareness comes in different ways, and if the film is able, or our work in general, our other work as well, is able to deliver some kind of awareness to people that gets them thinking about it, just like it got me thinking about it, then we're doing something right.
So Manufactured Landscapes is probably your best known and possibly, just a quick glance here, the best accredited as far as winner. You've got Best Canadian Documentary from several different film festivals across Canada when it came out, and a Genie for Best Feature Documentary in 2007, and a whole number of other ones. It's the sort of the basis by which you're getting the Eco Hero Canadian at the Planet and Film Festival. But the environment, to varying degrees and in varying context, has sort of been a theme. As you said, it's the first one that was sort of explicitly related to ecosystems and consumption. But there's definitely a theme there. Do you want to talk a little bit about environmental themes in some of your other films?
Well, I think that, I mean, the part of the way that we work making documentaries is not to come at them with a pre-written script or a very strong preconceived idea. I really think that you need to be, you need to have a plan, because if you don't have a plan, what you're doing is arbitrary. But if you don't have, if you're not able to be sensitive to the environment around you, then you don't see what's going on. You can't see reality. So you have to be able to abandon that plan at any moment. And part of that is just being sensitive to your surroundings. And so I think that place has always played quite a strong role in our documentaries, from our Paul Bowles documentary. I mean, Paul Bowles was an American who rejected dominant American culture and went to live in Morocco for 50 years and never returned. And the Termini of Pictures is about, you know, the people of Appalachia, also a marginalized group within dominant American culture, living in the mountains, and the way that they are perceived by others. And In Act of God, it was much more, that's a film about the metaphysical effects of being struck by lightning, and we were, you know, there's something quite great about the overpowering power of nature and being confronted by it. And in some of those situations it can be tragic, but it's very humbling to be in the middle of a thunderstorm. And I, you know, we shot a lot of those sequences ourselves. So we spent about a year filming different storms. And the interesting thing about that is that even though you can explain it as a natural scientific phenomenon, you know, weather, it's people can't help but believe that there is some kind of sign if you experience being struck by lightning, that you're being told something, that you're being given a message somehow. And almost universally with the people that we talked to who had been struck by lightning or been in the presence of lightning in that way, felt that way, even though they could explain it away scientifically. And I thought there was something really interesting about that. So, of course, for that film, we spent a lot of time outside, and a lot of time outside in the middle of storms. Payback is an adaptation of Margaret Atwood's Massey Lectures about debt. And when I first encountered it, I thought it was going to be about money, and I didn't think that I'd be in any way suitable to make a film about that, an economic crisis. And in fact, it's everything but that. It's an examination of owing and being owed, and how that is a fundamental back and forth in human society, that we don't even, perhaps are not really aware of how often we make these little tallies day to day, you know, thank you, no thank you, you know, you do me a favor, I do you a favor, etc. And she talks about these issues, but she also talks about ecological debt and how we are, you know, Atwood is an incredible environmentalist. In fact, mm-hmm. I think she is also an eco-hero, which again proves my point that I'm out of my depth. But she was, you know, when she talks about ecological debt, she talks about this endless borrowing that we just keep doing from the planet, and the way that expressed itself in the film was as an examination of the Gulf oil spill, which happened when we were making the film. And some of the things that we saw were just absolutely horrific. And there were so many, I mean, the dispersant that was used to kind of break up the oil, which, you know, could be argued was done for reasons of breaking up the oil ecologically, but were also done for reasons, cosmetic reasons, so that the oil couldn't be seen on the surface, where it would have been much, you know, easier to clean up, was the story or the question that we explored in that film. And the film that we're working on now is we're working with Patinsky again. In fact, Ed and I are co-directing this film. Nick is producing and filming it. He's a cinematographer, but it is about water and our interactions with water around the world. And he's been working on this essay for about 5 or 6 years now. And it's quite a fascinating topic because it's so vast. How we shape water to our use, essentially, mostly fresh water. And we've been sort of all over the world with that, and I'm now just starting the process of editing that film, and it's quite a challenge.
Unfortunately, that is actually all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for joining us, though, Jennifer Bickwall. If anyone is interested in seeing the film, if they haven't seen Manufactured Landscape, so they want to see it again, that's going to be playing during the Planet in Focus Film Festival. That's Friday, October the 12th at 5:15. You can also go hear Jennifer speak later on that day at 7:15 during the Canadian Eco Hero Award presentation. And was there another time when you were going to be around for a talk or people might be interacting?
Well, at that talk, there, Ed Pertinsky and Nick DePonsi are going to be there too, so it will be kind of an interesting talk about collaboration around these themes. And I'm also doing a workshop, but that's a sort of application thing where people have to apply, and that's earlier on in that day.
Absolutely. Okay, so if anyone's interested in seeing this film or any others or meeting Jennifer, you can go to planetinfocus.org to see their schedule there. And, of course, your films and information about Mercury Films is available at mercuryfilms.ca. Thank you so much for joining us today, Jennifer, on The Green Majority.
Thanks for having me. Okay. Bye-bye.
All right, thanks again to Jennifer for speaking to us about the Planet in Focus Film Festival. We're going to take a music break in just a moment, but first a couple of announcements, and we'll be right back after that music break with the international headlines. But first, we're going to be having Zina Maria coming back after the break. A couple of announcements regarding what's happening on the website. First, I've added some new content. We have our syndication page back up. So if you're wondering where you can listen live coast to coast, that information is now available at the new and improved Green Majority website. Still work in progress, but I think we're coming along nicely there. There's some new content. One of the other things that I've added to the site, of course, is a poll. There's a short poll because we want to know who's listening, and we don't actually have too much information. We know people are listening. We get, you know, CRTC reports and all that good stuff, and so I know there's somebody, but for us to be able to kind of gear the show more to who's listening and the type of content that you are interested in hearing, of course, there is the option of always sending us an email, but if you wouldn't mind taking a second, there's only about 8 questions, and I actually set up the questions on the poll. You'll see there it's under, if you go to greenmajority.ca, it says Help TGM. If you click on there, I actually made all the separate questions individually separate poll answers. So you can actually select if there's something you don't feel like answering or whatnot. It'll only take a second. And if you can just want to fill out one, that's fine. Every piece of information that you give us, of course, is anonymous. Even to us, we don't know who gave the information. It's not displayed to anybody else. We've sort of hidden all the results. It's just to kind of help us gear who's listening, what type of content might be most beneficial for you. So it would really help out the show and improve the show for your benefit. If you took a moment to do that, to go to greenmajority.ca, take a look at some of the new content that's up there. We now have embedded players and all sorts of fancy things. And take a second to, on the far right top corner of the screen there, it says Help TGM. Take a look at that. The wonderful and talented Leah Mazzolina will be in to read the international headlines in a second, but she's also doing other things in the studio now other than going to get me coffee and wonderful things like that. She'll be sitting in front of a computer checking our Twitter feed. So if during any of the interviews, even if it's a pre-record, live interview, anything like that, she's actually sitting in there all the time, unless you physically hear her on the air reading the headlines, checking that Twitter feed. So we're going to sort of test this out. We don't really have the equipment or the personnel to do live calls, but we're going to test out this way of sort of interacting with the show. If you have any questions, again, during a pre-record, during a live interview, anything like that, perhaps we're reading the headlines and you miss something, you have a further question for one of our guests while the interview is happening, Leah's going to be sitting there and sort of forwarding me anything that that she thinks is relevant. If someone has a question about any of the content at all or a question about the show, you can always send us an email. But if you want to do it during the show, if you'd like your question answered live, or perhaps for me to forward a question to one of our guests, you can go ahead and send that to our Twitter feed. Again, that's at Green Majority, as a way to interact live with the show. And one of the other benefits of tuning into that syndication page, if you're not in Toronto and you're not listening on CIUT, and you normally say listen and podcast, is a good reason to either go to the syndication page and find a station near you so you can listen live and participate with the show. If there isn't a station that's near you, then go ahead and send your nearest station an email and tell them that you'd like to hear The Green Majority. We're always taking new syndication as well. Anywhere in the country, if you have a radio station, I'm sure you can talk them into playing us. If they don't answer your email, get 10 of your friends to write them an email. Worst case scenario, write me one and I'll write them an email saying they should carry the show. No problem at all. So we're going to take a break now after one final thing, which is that we're coming up on our fundraiser. That's right, it's time for the fall fundraiser here at CIUT. So if you're on any of the other stations, you can absolutely still send us a donation. All the support helps us continue to produce the show. Of course, CIUT is a registered charity, so we have to do fundraisers. It's a member, listener-supported radio station, I guess, is the best way to put it, community station. That's going to be October 15th to 21st. The early bird prize draw, though, if you can win a $2,000 Sony Center for Performing Arts prize pack, if you register as a member, which is a minimum donation of $25 before October the 15th, whether or not you do that, you're entered in for all sorts of other prizes. There's also automatic gifts, depending on your gift level, t-shirts and special editions, all sorts of fun things like that. You can do it with PayPal, you can do it with a credit card, you can do it over the phone. So you can go to CIUT.fm if you want to register for that early, get in on those early prize draws. Just make sure that when you're filling out the donation form, it asks you what your favorite show is. That's where you put the green majority, because that gets attributed to us, and they know that you're calling or emailing or PayPaling or credit carding in to support the green majority. We do appreciate your support. Again, that fundraising show will be the week of October 15th to 21st, so we still got a little bit over a week to go for that. We're going to take a music break now, and we'll be back with your international headlines, so stay tuned. And welcome back. You're listening to The Green Majority, greenmajority.ca. And of course, we're produced live here at CIUT 89.5 in Toronto, or one of our wonderful community sponsors across the country, which you can now check out, as I was mentioning just before the break, on our website. That part of the website is back up. Syndication page, of course, go check out our polls as well. Give us some information so we know who's listening. And final reminder as well that our fundraising drive, the fall fundraising drive, is coming up October 15th to 21st. So you can go ahead and check out CIUT.fm for that. However, we now have Leah Mazzolini in the studio reading our international headlines.
Thanks, Darren. According to scientists, as ocean temperatures rise, fish sizes start to shrink. University of British Columbia researchers published a study in the Nature Climate Change Journal on Sunday, September 30th, saying that warmer water reduces the amount of oxygen in oceans, decreasing the size of more than 600 types of fish. Using computer models, scientists found fish sizes could diminish by 14 to 24% from 2000 to 2050 due to the temperature rising and the depletion of oxygen. Co-author of the study, William Chung, says predator-prey relationships shift as smaller fish move north, interfering with marine ecosystems. They predict that most fish populations would shift towards the poles at a median rate of up to 36 kilometers. Past studies were observing the reaction of ocean wildlife to climate change, and the effect of the overall fish size was a new venture. Chung adds that the next step to study is the precise effect it has on the fish ecosystems. Climate change is known to lower biodiversity, but now it's been linked to lowering the world's GDP. Humanitarian group DARA and Climate Vulnerable Forum created the Climate Vulnerability Monitor, which created a report with findings linking greenhouse gases to a shrinking economy. In the study, they calculated the climate change and carbon emissions are causing the world's GDP to plummet 1.6% a year, or at about $1.2 trillion. The paper further explains that without intervention, the global GDP could reduce by 3.2% a year by 2030. In some countries, as much as 11% drop in market value is a real possibility. Bangladesh Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina Wajed who participated in the panel discussion at a Climate Week New York City conference, made her concerns about affordability in the future. She explains that her South Asian country is a prime example of a high-risk nation due to its high population density and low income status. It's the second time for actress Daryl Hannah to be put into handcuffs from protesting against the proposed plans of the Keystone XL pipeline. The Kill Bill star and a 78-year-old landowner was arrested on Thursday, October 4th. The pair were blocking heavy machinery attempting to stop construction of the pipeline project in a small town east of Dallas. They are awaiting charges for criminal trespassing. Hannah has been very vocal about her opposition of the $7 billion pipeline, which is supposed to send heavy tar sands oil from Alberta to the Texas Gulf Coast. In August 2011, the actor was arrested as a protest in Washington that included hundreds of activists and scientists. Hannah, along with other environmentalists, say that the pipeline would be too risky because it would pump acidic crude oil that could easily corrode a metal pipe, leading to a spill. And that's all for the international news. I'm Leah Mazzolini.
Thank you very much, Leah. We'll send you back to that Twitter feed if anyone is interested in participating with the show. Again, we've got Zina Maria from the Sierra Youth Coalition talking about Sustainable Campus Conference 2012. That'll be coming up right after this music break.
I tried it. I couldn't fight it. Now I just want to get back to me. Oh, baby. Ooh-hoo. Back into the man I used to be. I tried it. I couldn't fight it. Now I just want to get back to me. Oh, baby. Ooh-hoo-hoo. Back into the man I used to be.
Things that I said I wouldn't do, I did them. Secrets below the surface, the truth, I hid them. As mankind has passed, I couldn't erase the tears of a million years. This human race of animals that talk and walk upright, the slave all day and fall into trance at night, roaming the planet, trying to find missing links, like the men we used to be and are we supposed to think? Mysteries, maybe not. It's getting hot, we better configure the plot. But I hold a pen with the grip so tight that I squeeze the ink down to the page and write a song for the people. Came up from the underground, now I ride above on a hovercraft of sound. This microphone like an amphetamine, keeping me clean, speaking in dreams so nature can intervene. It's all received.
I tried it, I couldn't fight it. Now I just wanna get back to me. Oh, baby. Ooh, back into the man I used to be.
And we are back. You're listening to The Green Majority, greenmajority.ca. Remember, you can send us an email if you'd like via internet snail mail. That is regular email. thegreenmajority@gmail.com. What I mean by internet snail mail is we have Leah sitting at the computer today in front of the Twitter feed. So if you have any questions for this guest, any comments about the show or anything at all that you want to get to us as fast as humanly possible, you can go ahead and send us a direct message at Green Majority. However, we're going to go now to Zina Maria from the Sierra Youth Coalition. How are you doing today, Zina?
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
Fantastic. So we're going to be talking a little bit about the Sustainable Campus Conference 2012 that's going to be happening here in Toronto. But first, let's start sort of at the beginning. If you want to tell the listeners just a little bit, in case they're not terribly familiar with Sierra Youth Coalition, just exactly who they are and what they do.
Yeah, sure. So the Sierra Youth Coalition is actually the youth arm of the larger Sierra Club, which has been around for decades. And we've been around in Canada since about the year 19. The end of the 1999, so 1998, 1999, and our job is really to empower and speak for the youth of Canada when it comes to environmental issues, sustainability issues, climate change, and all those things that are important to them. It's run by youth for youth nonprofit, and we want to largely empower our youth membership base.
Okay, and I think here's the key part of the issue there with just even the idea that there needs to be a specific, I mean, because there's already Sierra Club of Canada, right? So
yep.
We've got a sort of Sierra Club of Canada sponsored specifically and somewhat autonomous and separate youth coalition. Why is that? Why is there a separate youth component to it? Why is that necessary?
Well, I suppose it came out of a need at the time, or an interest at least, to have some organization specifically dedicated to the issues that students find important. And so that sort of has been reflected in the programming that we've developed over the past 10 years or more. We have large focuses on things happening on campuses. So we have the higher education colleges and university programs, and we also have a lot of programming dedicated to the high school students. So that's how, those are things that I guess could in theory slip past the larger Sierra Club's mandate. It's just their mandate is so broad and so far reaching that it really helps to have something specifically focused on students' realities.
Okay, so that brings us to this year's Sustainable Campus Conference for 2012. Mm-hmm. I've been looking through your program a little bit, and you know, we look at a lot of conferences here, and we've talked about Tools for Change recently, for instance, on the program, which is sponsored by, among other groups, Greenpeace, and those are kind of like activist workshops and stuff like that, and so they talk about like how to talk to the media and whatnot. You've got a very different sort of role here that you're looking to play. With some of the topics, I mean, one of the ones that jumped right out at me was stakeholder loyalty was something that sort of jumped out at me immediately as an issue that I hadn't even really considered. Do you want to tell me a little bit about sort of what that means and why that needs to be its own sort of presentation at the conference?
Sure, yeah. So just a word on our programming, I guess, in general first and how we do that. Since we are so such a membership-focused and organization, we want our conferences to reflect what our members have to say. So we didn't go out necessarily trying to book workshops. We really listened to our members who proposed those. So quite a few of those workshops were proposed by and are being led by students. So the one that you brought up is one of those examples. And we're actually really excited about that particular workshop because it's the first time in our conference history that we're having an international presenter. So Anthony Monnier, who's presenting the stakeholder loyalty, is actually coming from a university in South Africa. So we're kind of really excited to have him participate and to share his perspective. We've always, up until this point, focused on Canadian youth and students at Canadian universities, and so this is going to be an opportunity to get a totally different perspective from such a different context. So Anthony, I think why we thought his talk was important, other than just the fact of having an international voice, was that we work a lot on the idea of stakeholders in general and involving stakeholders. We focus a lot on a multi-stakeholder approach in all of our work, and so I thought it would be interesting to hear what this particular presenter had to say and what his particular slant on that was.
So what are some of the, and maybe you can answer this question by referring to some of the presentations that you've got, but what are the sorts of issues that that people come across as far as either ideas they want to implement at a campus level that would be sort of applicable to this, and potentially some of the issues that come along that require support for these decisions? I mean, it's not as easy as sort of walking into your school's office and saying, I'd like these changes. So you know, explain I guess, why there needs to be a conference and the types of things that you're going to be talking about there.
Yeah, of course. I mean, one of the main reasons that we want to have the conference is to fulfill our dual mandate of educating and empowering and giving capacity to our students. So there are going to be some workshops that are going to be more on the educational level, just information sharing, not to say that they won't be interactive and there won't be possibility for the students to feedback into it, but there will be some of those things. I'm thinking about some of the workshops that are going to be tours of the green facilities and green features at the UTM campus, University of Toronto Mississauga campus, where we're going to be. So there will be things like that will be more just about learning about what initiatives are happening at our host campus and from other campuses that are going to be there. And then the other side is more what you've been talking about in terms of building capacity or giving students tools. So a big one of that is one of our staff members, Sarah English, is going to be giving a workshop on how to implement a multi-stakeholder initiative at your home campus. So that's going to be a sort of interactive role-playing workshop that's going to let students really test out what that looks like and think about what they would have to do to get all the different groups involved if they're going to do something successful, a successful sustainability initiative on their home campus.
Well, that's fantastic. So the conference itself is from October 11th to October 14th.
Yeah.
As you said, that's going to be in Toronto. That happens to be, funnily enough, that we did the Planet in Focus sort of interview free in the first half, because that's over the same weekend. So
competition.
I don't think necessarily it's competition. Where I was actually going with that was that if you are not in the Toronto area, that would make an excellent reason now to come down to the Toronto area to make
Definitely.
That trip, because you're able to maximize your time. You can go and see some of the presentations at the conference, maybe catch a few flicks in between.
Yeah.
So a great weekend. For those that are not within sort of range of Toronto and not able to actually get to this conference, what sort of resources do you have available for students across the country? Of course, we have listeners all the way from, you know, BC to St. John's. So
yeah,
what are some of the other resources that people can access? Are there other conferences that you guys put on across the country, or are there resources online? What sort of information do you have available?
We definitely have a lot of information and a lot of resources on CRU's Coalition's main website, which anybody can access, and that's syc-cjs.org. There's also a conference website, which is sustainablecampuses.ca. And just to make sure that it's clear, this is a national conference, so we do have students coming in from across the country. And I know it's a little bit last minute now to make travel arrangements like that, but we do definitely welcome participation from anybody, regardless of where they're from. And for those in the Toronto area, if they only really have time to drop by for one thing, I would highly recommend our keynote address on Saturday afternoon, because we have made it a public event by donation, and Maud Barlow is our keynote speaker this year. So if anybody wants to come by for one event, I would definitely recommend that one. It's Saturday at 5 p.m.
Absolutely. And are there any other presentations that really jumped out at you as something that you want to mention that people should definitely be checking out?
Well, we talked about a couple of the workshops that I'm pretty excited about, and there's sort of a whole cluster of them that's going to be talking about food issues and water issues, and I think that has to do with this year's theme of the healthy campus. So we're looking at the links between human health and the health of our environment and our ecosystems. So those two themes, food and water, are pretty well represented in our programming, and I know that they tend to be issues that students often will latch onto with a lot of enthusiasm.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much for joining us today. Zina, if you want to just say the website again and how people can register, if there's any other information you'd like to let our listeners know about, go ahead.
Definitely. Well, the conference website is sustainablecampuses.ca, and on that website you should be able to register and see our program as it is right now and all the other details. And if you want more information on Sierra Youth, you can go to that website, which is syc-cjs.org. And we're also on Facebook under Sierra Youth Coalition. There's an event page there for the conference. And we do post Twitter updates as well.
All right. Well, thank you very much today for speaking to us today. Zina, of course, you should go and check out that conference, Sierra Youth Coalition, and she just gave all the websites and stuff. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So we're going to have one more music break, and we'll be back to hear from Kevin Farmer, our own in-house Dr. Doom, right after this music break. And we are back here on The Green Majority, and we're going to be speaking to Kevin Farmer. I also have Leah back in the studio as well. Are you there, Kevin?
Hi, Darren.
And how are you doing this morning?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Fantastic. So I wanted to talk a little bit today. I sort of picked our topic this week because something grabbed my attention. Having to do with the American debates, obviously, or Canadian show, we mostly talk about Canadian politics, but American politics is highly relevant to Canadian politics for obvious reasons. I would hope for most people, obviously, we're extremely linked through trade and obviously and through policy, and there's a lot of information sharing going back and forth, and there seems to be sort of increasingly tied together the longer we go. So one of the things that had been pointed out, now we're just kind of referring to a Huffington Post article, an opinion piece, but was talking about the success of a public campaign to get 160,000 signatures for support of asking a question regarding climate change during the first presidential debate. And the kind of gist of the article and a kind of point which I think I very much voice as well was the ridiculousness of needing 160,000 signatures to ask a question about something that's scientifically pretty much certain. To the sake that, you know, to the essence of that science is certain about anything, they're certain about climate change. And I just sort of thought that whole idea was ridiculous, and I was sure that you would have something to say about that. But anyway, I'll sort of let you go first if you want, but your sort of reaction to, first of all, the campaign itself, and then sort of my point about it being ridiculous that this was even necessary to get a single question asked about such an important issue.
Well, it's ridiculous. It's absurd. Climate change is an existential threat, and it has completely dropped off the radar of American politics. You know, anyone who follows environmental news knows that the state of the discourse in the states regarding climate change has really dried up. But a couple of sentences from the article that you're referencing, I just want to read them out because they really highlight it. The article says, according to the Union of Concerned Scientists, recent analysis shows that from February to July of 2012, 37 of the 40 climate references made by Fox News Channel were misleading. Only 3 were accurate. And a one-year look at the Wall Street Journal, with more than 2 million daily readers and the largest circulation among American newspapers, reveals that 81% of the opinion page coverage was misleading. So you know, even from their news sources, we can't even get informed debate coming from, you know, widely viewed news sources. It's given the complexity of the issue, it would just be impossible to suppose that you know, kind of the mythical average person would have a clear understanding of climate change when they can't even trust their news sources, who, you know, I mean, these news organizations have editorial boards, they have research staff, and they can't even make accurate commentary about climate change. It's no wonder that the people who are aware of the issue are pushed to the extreme of having to petition to get a single question about an existential threat in the presidential debate.
Mm. I think to be fair, and I guess that's not being terribly fair, but to be as fair as we can be, part of the issue with with this whole idea of reporting and misinforming, I mean, you'll note, of course, the listener should note that when you're reading that 1 year Lo-Stung, that was 81% of opinion pieces. The reason they went with that statistic, one, was the kind of drastic number that had misinformation in them, but also that there are far more opinion pieces being published about these topics than news pieces, if you will. And the distinction there is important, which is that when there's an opinion piece, really there's not a lot of fact-checking that's done because the newspapers are losing a lot of their revenue, and so a lot of the staff has been come back. We've covered that. That's part of the reason why supporting the Green Majority, by the way, such an important idea, because mainstream news outlets are losing, money, and the first things to get cut are their experts. So they, if they do cover it at all, issues are being covered by people who are not experts or have any training necessarily at all and the issues that they're covering. We of course talked with a few weeks ago with a doctor explaining all the bad coverage on the CBC about the organic food report that had come out, and how it wasn't that the doctor disagreed with the report, it's that the news people who were covering the story, and the story went absolutely viral, sort of made its way all the way across the airwaves. They just didn't understand it. They just didn't understand how to read the scientific report. And so I think that, I mean, that's definitely part of it. Part of the problem is that, the real news sources are either misinforming people by accident, without even going to intentional misinformation. We'll sort of leave Fox News out of this for a second. even outside of sort of intentional misinformation, there's all this unintentional bad information that's coming out because people don't understand how to process the information, and then people read it in a newspaper and assume that therefore, these people are experts and they've done tons of research, when a lot of the time, these articles are thrown together in the last minute to meet a deadline, done by people who don't really have any background on what they're talking about. And that's kind of giving them the most benefit of the doubt possible. So it's I think it's no surprise that the vast majority of the pieces that are being put out are opinion pieces.
Well, I think opinion pieces hold a lot of sway. I think a lot of people rely on them for analysis of the news. And like you say, people are generally not, scientifically literate, so they can't read these reports and decipher the language, and they rely on so-called experts to tell them what it means. And it's just a tragedy of the highest order that in the nation that consumes 20% of the world's energy, that there's no coherent discussion about climate change. And of course, if Romney wins, the GOP is ideologically opposed to action on climate change. And even if Obama wins, the electorate is so concerned about the economy that they're not going to tolerate any perceived threat to the economy, which is always the false dichotomy with environmental choices. And so there will be no global leadership on climate change. The world's second largest emitter will still be doing nothing, and the pressure on Canada to show the political pressure on Canada will be absolutely zero. So I'm sure you can call me Dr. Doom, but I don't think we.
I believe I did call you Dr. Doom. Let's be clear.
We just don't have much to look forward to with regards to the climate change debate. And again, I'll give a shout out to our fundraising, though. This is definitely why you need to support shows like the Green Majority, that all of us are educated on the topic, and we have the sense to discern, accurate news from inaccurate news, and we vet what we're talking about, and we interview people who are genuinely experts on what they're talking about. And if you can't trust the mainstream media, you've got to. And with just the urgency of environmental news in today's reality, it's vital to support a news show like the Green Majority that gives accurate information.
Yeah, I think that's a great pitch and a great place to leave off. Unfortunately, I know Leah, I think Leah had something to say, but we're out of time, unfortunately. Maybe I'll encourage her to put that on the Facebook feed on the way out if someone has further comment. We are unfortunately out of time. As I said, that piece we were commenting on, though, is also an opinion piece. So I'm going to be linking to that article on the website with the show post that goes up later today. So if you have any comments about any parts of the show, any parts about our commentary at the end specifically, or if you want to just read the article that we were referring to, that will all be on the website later today. That is all the time we have for today, unfortunately. So thank you very much to Ryan Knight, who is, of course, our tech today. Webcasting and podcasting is provided by the web consulting firm rjgcreative.com. You've been listening to The Green Majority, Canada's All-Environmental News Hour. I'm Darren Kaser, and that's it for today's live edition. Until next week, thanks for listening.